A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Matt Cain, Editor-in-Chief of Attitude, and thanks for joining me on this latest Attitude Heroes podcast. Attitude Heroes is sponsored by the Great Britain Campaign, which welcomes the world to visit, do business, invest and study in the UK. You can check out their website at great.gov.uk. And our co-sponsors are Jaguar. If you'd like more information on their products, then you can visit the website jaguar.co.uk or look out for them in the latest issue of Attitude magazine. My guest today is a musician who'll be instantly recognisable to anyone who grew up listening to pop music in the 80s and 90s. And he's someone who's still going strong 30 years on. He's also someone who made a massive impact on me personally, as he was one of the very first men I came across who was openly gay. In fact, I can still remember being completely blown away by an interview with him in Smash Hits magazine all those years ago, because I simply hadn't encountered anyone who was so upfront about his sexuality. And all this at a time when I was just starting to understand mine. He is Andy Bell from Erasure. I've got to tell you right away that Andy was very candid when we spoke. So if strong language offends you, you could always switch this off and listen to Erasure's greatest hits instead. If you've chosen to stay with us, and I hope you have, you'll hear Andy talk about his lack of confidence.
Then it was, you know, it was very hip to be kind of like gender bending and stuff like that, you know. But I was hopeless at doing it. I mean, I used to go out, you know, in heaven and wear drag and go with my friends. And again, I was so shy, I couldn't even speak to anybody.
About the ups and downs of being a gay icon?
I think gay people got a bit sick of me. I was voted to go back in the closet one time. I did get the keys to San Francisco in 1988. I think in 1989 they voted me back in the closet. I don't know.
And how club music goes hand in hand with lust.
You really felt like being a rabbit in the headlights, that you had to sleep with so many men in a short time, because all the music, all the songs were all about that.
So, on a lovely sunny day, let's go and sit down with Andy Bell in his very swish penthouse flat in London's Docklands. Andy. Thank you for having us.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's great to be here in your glamorous flat underneath an Andy Warhol of the Queen.
Shh. Yeah.
It's very calm.
Well, it took me a long time to get it, so I just got it last year, so I'm kind of very pleased.
Is it your prized possession?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And where are all the gold discs? I expected platinum gold discs all over the walls.
Yeah, they are in the cupboard. They used to be in my... In my office in the when I lived in Highgate. I moved here 3 years ago, and they were on the wall, not all of them, just like a few, but there's no room to put them really, but I think they're better in the wall, in the airing cupboard. they make good gifts, because you get always people asking for charity things to sign, you know. They make quite good gifts.
Anyway, it's great to meet you. And actually, it's quite emotional for me meeting you, because I was always a massive fan of Erasure when I was growing up, a massive fan. But I have a confession to make. When I first became aware of you, when Sometimes was a big hit, I would have been about 11.
Yeah.
And I was quite frightened of you.
Oh.
Because you, to me, represented... You were literally the only gay person out there,
right,
for so long. And you represented to me what other people were telling me was wrong, and what I didn't want to become.
Yeah.
At that time, when you were so publicly gay...
Right.
It really was not accepted, was it?
It wasn't, not really. I mean, the reason that I felt comfortable doing it was because Jimmy Somerville was already there.
Yeah.
And to me, and he was like a real hero to me. And, I mean, from Small Town Boy, you know, it gave me goosebumps, that song. And I was very fortunate, because I mean, I'd moved down to London with the intention of being in a band, and also because I thought felt Peterborough was too small to be gay. And, you know, I had a girlfriend when I moved to London, but then she helped me to kind of come out and stuff. She took me to my first gay group.
Oh, my God, Matt, can I just say, you've said about five things there that I want to repeat. You've said growing up in Peterborough, you've said the band, you've had a girlfriend.
Yeah.
She helped you to come out.
Yeah.
But, sorry, yeah, so being so publicly gay when there were so few of you. Yeah, Jimmy Somerville beat you to it by a couple of years.
Yeah.
But even so...
Well, I just decided, you know, I mean, Erasure were touring a lot, especially in the early days. I mean, we still do, but in the early days, and we were going to North America a lot, and I thought, like, well, I'm just going to make this show like a gay pride parade, you know. And I remember on the very first single that we released, which didn't get played, Vince and I were both wearing drag. And I think it was like, Vince thought it was really cool that I was gay, because, you know, I thought it was kismet when we met, you know, and I answered an ad for him. And
because he'd already been in Yazoo.
Yeah, he was in Yazoo and Depeche Mode. And I thought, who's the most left-field person in pop that I could possibly work with? And I thought, Vince Clarke. And I thought I should write him a letter and see if he needs a new singer, because he had just split with Alison Moyet. And after I'd left my girlfriend, I'd had a boyfriend for about 6 months. We were living together. And then I had another boyfriend, and he lived in one of the last cooperative houses, gay cooperatives in London, off Holloway Road. So I moved in there with him, and it was a huge house. And they had Lisa Power there, Andy Picos, all these people like working for Gay Switchboard, Pink Paper. So my education was just like, bam, you know, straight away.
You went from a girlfriend to that.
Yeah, all about gay stuff, you know. And we were going around and reviewing bars. I was taking the photos of the bars for the Pink Paper with my friend. And, so it was kind of a baptism of fire, really, in the house. And I was kind of I was very fortunate because I didn't really have a job then. And so I did kind of part-time things and looked after the house. But I remember one of my housemates, Andy, who now works with Gok Kwan, he said, because I used to rehearse to Yazoo Records and Alison Moyet Records, and he said, oh, this is going to be you in 1 year's time. And I thought, well, how do you know that?
But you know what? It's interesting because you say that Vince Clarke was cool and edgy and this, that, the other, and he saw you being gay as cool, which is absolutely... true that he had that cool thing at the time, but at the same time, to the mainstream, there was this hysteria around being gay, wasn't there? Particularly when the AIDS crisis really...
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I was already out anyway, so to come out in pop was... I saw they advertised they had a Gays in Rock seminar at the ICA, so I went to it. You know, just when I first started working with Vince, and either Jimmy was going to be there or Tom Robinson was there. And so Tom Robinson was there, and I just waited till the end of the seminar, and I said to Tom, oh, how do you come out in music? Because I didn't know how you do it. So he said that he wore a pink triangle badge and waited till people asked him questions. So I just thought, like, when we did interviews for Smash Hits and things like that, if they ask you about... you know, are you seeing anybody? I'll just say, yeah, I've got my boyfriend. But I met my partner then the same time as I met Vince, so my whole life kind of changed. My life partner then, Paul. So my whole life kind of changed, not overnight, but over a couple of years. So we had, I probably had about 4 years of freedom, I would say, on the gay scene.
Before the AIDS crisis,
and it was really a weird experience because of being so shy as well. You know, one of my girlfriends from Peterborough, another girl, she was punk girl. She had a brother who was gay who'd moved to London, and she had left school. So I used to go around to her house and like have a cup of tea and stuff and stay as long as I could, just so I could hear stories about her brother. And she told me this. About this club called Heaven in London. And there was this other club in the back called Cha-Cha-Cha's that was like...
I've not heard of that one.
A bit sort of trendy and stuff, you know, and had punks and goths going there. And that's where I wanted to go to.
But you know what? It's interesting to me that you went from... You've said that you're shy.
Yeah.
And you've said that you were shy and that you had this kind of curiosity about gays and you didn't know how to come out as a gay pop star. And you went from that to just kind of being so completely out, you know, performing on stage with your bum hanging out of chaps with no knickers and...
Yeah, I think I was kind of one of those people where, even though I was really shy, you know, if I felt compelled to do something, I'd do it like all guns blazing. Because, like, even when I was in school, I had, you know, one of my best friends, we ended up being boyfriends, and then I got dumped. Because it was, you know, it was that kind of... shame story again, you know, the embarrassment story.
So was this, this is while you were at school?
Yeah, this was in Peterborough, in my secondary school.
Oh, and were you in love with him?
I wouldn't say I was in love with him. I mean, we were really, really close. But then there were two other guys who were like, in the next year, who I knew really well, one of them, and they used to walk around school holding hands.
So, oh my God, your school sounds like a gay bar.
I know, so I
needed
kind of
to
like,
go to that school.
You know, I said, I mean, I really had a crush on them so bad because they were like really good looking and everything. And so I said to them, I said, do you mind if I come and meet you after school? And they said, yeah, okay then. And one of them lived a few doors down. So I went and knocked on the door and I thought, well, and they said, yeah, what is it? And I said, well, I can only tell you the truth. I'm in love with you both.
Oh,
and they said like, oh no, it's not. They said, well, it's not real. We're just pretending like just to kind of shock people and stuff like that. But in some ways, I couldn't tell. But I know that I did sleep with one of them later on, who had a girlfriend.
Oh my God! You know. As did you?
Yeah.
This is quite a barrage of. There's a lot going on here, isn't
there?
Yeah.
So you know, I kind of. I mean, in Peterborough, I just felt so frustrated. I was so frustrated. I was like, I ended up making little drawings in my exercise books of flick porn. You know, like doing the actual drawings.
What if like.
Of like of someone coming or something, you know, and just making it like a little flick book because you couldn't get anything. You know, you had either a catalogue, a Freeman's catalogue,
or I used to look at the, I was going to say the Argos catalogue, but it wasn't, it used to be like the Next Directory or something, didn't it?
Yeah.
In my day, and you used to look at the underwear at the back and see the bulges.
So I still have a fetish for those 70s pants, you know, those like, or like, I call them straight pants. I really like those straight
my
pants.
Yeah, friends with the whole sack of spuds, whatever, hanging
out. Yeah. So anyway, I used to, just when I joined Erasure, Vince said, oh, he kind of twigged that I was gay because... all these boys kept coming around to the studio. I was kind of showing off, you know, to people. And but I was going to heaven at the same time on Wednesdays. And I went probably for about a year without speaking to anyone. I would just go and sit in the same place every time. They probably thought I was a freak or something. And, you know, you see Boy George there and Kenny Everett and Marilyn and all these people. And I was just, like, gobsmacked. I was like, my mouth was just dropping open.
But that's fascinating to me that you sat there and didn't speak to anybody. Your mouth was dropping open. You went from that to being out there on stage, totally gay, in drag, in sequins, feather boas, when, you know, Boy George wasn't publicly out. The Pet Shop Boys weren't publicly out. George Michael wasn't publicly out. There was you, Jimmy Somerville, beat you by a year or so, and Colin and Barry on EastEnders.
Yeah.
But you put yourself on the front line.
Yeah, I did do, purposely.
Did you feel vulnerable? Did you feel like you were in the firing line?
Yes, to me that was the whole part of it, was being vulnerable, was that you knew that at any moment, you know, you were completely naked and completely bare and bearing your soul, and at any moment anything could happen. So it's kind of like, I mean, things did happen. You know, we had right up until 1997... I mean, we were on tour with David Bowie, of all people, you know, and rotating with No Doubt being the headliner before he came on. And we got booed, like, for the whole show. We were booed. They were throwing missiles at us. And they were all mooning, like the boys, getting on their girlfriend's shoulders and taking their pants down, and showing their bums off.
So how did you feel when you were getting... So, and also in the press, you had a lot of abuse. If you were making yourself vulnerable and putting yourself out there, putting your head above the parapet for all of us, how did you feel emotionally?
I just felt like that was my purpose. You know, I didn't feel like... I just felt like that was normal. You know, that's what you're supposed to do. that I felt like. And I thought, I can't perform in any other way. Because in some ways I sort of felt like, okay, so you want a gay stereotype, so I'm going to give you one, and kind of like make it even more over the top than it really is, you know, because, and also, I mean, like then it was, you know, it was very hip to be kind of like gender bending and stuff like that, you know. And, but I was hopeless at doing it. I mean, I used to go out, you know, in heaven and wear drag and go with my friends. And again, I was so shy, I couldn't even speak to anybody.
And when you started, when you and Vin started playing your music to record execs and when you got signed, did anybody, what was the conversation like around your sexuality? Did anybody advise you not to be out or to tone it down?
It was really okay, really. I mean, Vince was already with Mute. And he's been with them forever, and so have I, because I came along with Vince. I came as part of Vince. So and it's always been totally fair. You know, Daniel's really cool. He has the most obscure artists on Mute. And, you know, in the beginning we did the video in drag, and then I wanted to do the second video as Judy in Wizards of Oz, you know. And they said, well, and they made me this gingham dress, and it was really awful. So I went for this spacesuit kind of look instead, like Thunderbirds. And then on sometimes when we wore the jeans and the T-shirt, and that all of a sudden that was a hit. You know, it was kind of like you couldn't really work out. It was like, oh, because that's your straight drag almost, you know, the T-shirt and jeans. And then later on when our hits weren't doing so well, somebody said, oh, can't you put a dress on? Like back to get some headlines. You know, I remember one time wearing the rubber leotard, a clip on top of the pops, and this was for Victim of Love, and then the single just jumped up like 40 places or something like that, you know?
Interestingly, you had a string of hit singles, but your albums always sold in massive quantities. Yeah. So actually, there's no way it could have just been gay people buying your music. So this argument that existed at the time, that it was bad for sales to camp it up too much you know, to come out. And there was some, you know, people like Boy George, the Pet Shop Boys, didn't come out at the beginning. You know, George Michael for ages. Yeah. You actually, weirdly, proved that wrong, didn't you?
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose I was quite harmless, you know. I was kind of the boy next door looking, and, you know, I wasn't really outrageous apart from being on the stage, I don't think.
Well, your work wasn't kind of sexually confrontational. Like Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Relax was quite
in your face.
You were in our faces, but it was with a kind of cheeky smile,
right?
Rather than with that dark kind of I might fuck you kind of thing. You know, yours was kind of sweet.
I think
and
some
cuddly.
People got a bit sick of me. I think gay people got a bit sick of me. I was voted to go back in the closet one time.
Who did that?
I don't know. It was somewhere in America, you know, even though it was I did get the keys to San Francisco in 1988. I think in 1989 they voted me back in.
Well, it's interesting you should say that though, because I said to you right at the beginning of this that I was always a massive fan, but at the beginning, when I wasn't comfortable with myself, admittedly, I was 11 at the time.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, I was frightened of you and what you represented. You know, that's what I had to say honestly. And I suppose if gay men, when you were really famous and you were on stage with sequins and feather boas and chaps with no knickers and your bum hanging out, then people who aren't comfortable with that side of themselves are going to not like you, are they?
Right. I don't know. It's really strange. I mean, when I think back to it, you know, I mean, I was teased from really early on, from probably like, I didn't even understand, you know, like walking to junior school and stuff like that, you know, and getting called girl and sissy and things like that. And I had long hair and I had four sisters. So, you know, my mum was really creative, you know, and I could talk about anything with her. And she never bought us war toys. You know, we weren't allowed guns. So we always had like puppets and musical instruments and really creative things. But you know, I mean, I had no idea what being a sissy was or what being gay was.
Well, my experience was I was told all that about myself before I realised what it was. But that's why I started to learn about it. That's why, you know, because other people said I was gay, so I had to work out what gay was.
What it was, yeah.
So what was your mum like about your girliness?
Well, I never, ever got scolded. I mean, one time I got called a girl by my dad, and that really hurt me. It was only ever one time, but I think I was being a real cow, so I deserved it, you know. But and then I had, like, four sisters, and then my baby brother was only born as I was leaving home, so... You know, I'd had girls all around me, so... And I didn't trust the children my own age where we lived because they were too spiteful. So I only played with younger people or with older relatives.
What do you mean they were spiteful? Because they were horrible to you?
Yeah, they were really nasty. They were like...
Because they thought you were gay, they thought you were different.
Yeah, because you were weak or whatever. They would, like, push you over the wall or...
It's a horrible way to grow up, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, they would whip you. I got whipped with... Privet hedge sticks, you know, with the leaves stripped off and things like that.
But you're saying it with a smile on your face. That kind of thing is actually a trauma for a child to live through. When we're distanced from we can laugh about it, can't we? But I sometimes look back at some of the things people used to say and do to me, and it's like a trauma to live through, especially when you don't feel you can tell any adults or parents or whatever because you're ashamed of the things that they're saying to you.
Yeah, I think it's it just makes you really, really sensitive and closes you in and kind of makes you realise just how cruel humans can be. And I still think that now. I think it's wicked. I think it's one of those things that kind of, like, goes up and down. I mean, your heart does close down, definitely, I think, because just depending on your mood in the world and how you reflect on things, you know, just on things that have happened to you. But then after a while, you just slowly, you start trusting again.
Mm. But it's interesting that you say you didn't trust other kids because they were so horrible to you.
I still don't. Even now, like young teenagers, I don't trust them whatsoever.
So it had a real impact on your psyche, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, yeah.
And so that was the kids on your council estate. What about Peterborough as a kind of small town England in the 60s, in the 70s?
Yeah.
What was it like to grow up as a boy who knew that he was different? And
it was kind of all right, you know, You know, I mean, they weren't really horrible, rough council estates or anything. It was like, you know, I had my cousins up the road. I had two girls across the road called Coral and Cherry. And then we'd play... I was always, like, trying to do theatre as well. So you'd have... I'd be making tickets, like rolls of tickets, and putting all the chairs out on the lawn and putting a tea chest for a cauldron. And, you know, playing It's a Knockout and spraying the lawn with fairy liquid, so it was all slippery.
But, you know what, it's interesting that when you were doing all this stuff, which was expressive and creative and basically expressing who you were, other boys, anyway, turned against you.
Yes, I mean, I did used to mess around with my next-door neighbour as well.
Oh.
So it was kind of...
So there were the two... So there was the boyfriend at school, the two other ones. So there was somebody else.
There was quite a few. I mean, I was quite... I didn't really realise, you know, this was all at different ages. And I was telling this Irish lady once on the aeroplane, I was sitting next to her and telling her a bit about my life. And she goes, "Oh, you're just a randy bugger." That's what she said.
So do you think that's what it is? Do you think it's that simple? It's nothing to do with...
Well, I think it was to do with, like, being really, really frustrated.
Yeah.
You know, like, just to the point of, maybe that's just teenage hormones, but, you know, to the point of when you're, like, boiling and you're just going to explode over, you know.
Yeah, so what you've described is what sometimes makes people angry. So is this how your anger chose to present itself, as sexual frustration and being what the woman on the plane said?
Probably.
You're a randy bugger or whatever.
Probably, yeah. I mean, you know, I used to kind of try and go cottaging in Peterborough, but it was so small.
I love the fact that I haven't even had to try to make you, open up. You've gone straight in there with all these boys you were having sex with.
You couldn't go there. I mean, you know, I worked on the market and used to go and have my lunch break in the toilet, but I would never, ever do anything. I only used to, like, just look through the latch key or whatever, you know.
So this is public toilets in Peterborough?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I thought, well, there weren't any more toilets, so I have to go somewhere else.
And did you ever see guys wanking themselves off at the urinals or whatever?
To be honest, I can't really remember. I think my first erect one that I saw, apart from being in school, was in Skegness. In the fairground. Yeah, in the fairground.
What, some guy got his dick out for you?
No, in the toilet. And my cousin said, what are you doing in big... What are you so long in there for? And I was, because I could see a...
Were you just looking at it, or did you get a go on it?
No. Because I was in the next cubicle, so I just looked through the little crack.
Well, so this is how sexually frustrated you were, and how you were literally looking through cracks in public toilets.
Yes. Yeah, like, it's still very much, you know, I'm kind of very voyeuristic. Because of that.
And right, so can we just go back? Yeah. So there's the boy on the same estate as you, and there's the boyfriend at school.
Yeah.
So I needed to grow up.
They all came out later as well. So, you know, it wasn't just experimenting, messing around.
So right. So if you were in your teens, and you knew that any sign of gayness, everybody turned on you. You knew that you weren't supposed to be like that.
Yeah.
But you were attracted to it. What was going through your head when you were with these boys? Was it not that? Because I can remember that heart beating thing. You were terrified of making the first move because nobody would say.
Yes.
You didn't identify openly as gay. So it was all, you didn't know whether they'd turn against you.
Yeah, we kind of had, with my friend, we kind of pretended we were doing a photo session with one of those Canon cameras.
And ended up getting your dick
out. And started, like, you know, just being more and more provocative with the poses. Yeah,
it was like a whole dance, wasn't it? You couldn't go straight to it. You couldn't address it. You had to dance around it. Excited, adrenaline going.
Yeah.
But terrified as well.
Yes.
Which was the first of all these boys? Which was the first one that you had a sexual experience?
I think
with?
The first one must have been my next door neighbour. Yeah, probably maybe 10 or 11 or 12, because I remember him saying once over the back garden fence, you know, have you had your jab yet? Like, meaning your inoculations for whatever. And I thought he said, have you had your jam? So I thought he meant, have you come? And so for a while I was like really very concerned, you know, that I haven't managed to ejaculate, you know. I mean, also because I was called sissy so much, I mean, the milkman, we used to help him on his milk round. He said to me, oh, Andy, you don't half walk like a girl, you know. And I thought, well, how does a girl walk? I mean, I was trying not to walk like a girl, and it really like screwed me up a bit, you know.
I know it does.
And I kind of thought, you know the line that you have on your scrotum?
Yeah.
I thought I was an experimental sex change.
What, because you had a line 60s. In the scrotum?
Yeah, I thought that was a scar from going from being a girl to a boy.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I remember looking at my private parts, thinking everything was wrong. What was wrong with me? You had no idea in those days, before the internet, what was normal. Yeah. I actually have a girlfriend who went to the doctors when she was about 12 and said there was something wrong with her down below because she didn't know what a vagina looked like, and she thought there was something wrong with hers.
Yeah.
And so it's not just gays, but with us, we thought we were aberrations of nature, didn't we? We thought it was all wrong.
I don't know. I just thought I was, you know, an experimental sex change. And then...
tell us about... So you were taking, pretending to have a photo shoot with this boy next door. So what was it like, the moment that you first kissed him?
I don't know if we kissed.
Oh, did you go straight?
I don't think we kissed. I can't really really remember what happened. I think probably kissing was maybe the last thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What? Straight down to business.
I don't think we ever kissed.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it was about kissing.
It was about
it was more being intrigued with
what was the other one like?
Feeling each other's dicks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what about the boy at school?
Well, that was the boy at school, that one.
Oh, he was that...
With the photo session.
Oh, right, oh, sorry.
But the other one, I'm not sure how that happened. I think that just came from, like laying on the sofa and being... laying on top of each other or something. I did try to seduce a boy once when he stayed at my house for the school holidays. He was a boarder, because we had half boarding house and half day boys. And we got really drunk and we were talking about being bisexual and everything. And I took that as being like a come on. And I tried to seduce him, and then he...
What did that consist of, trying to seduce him?
Well,
because
he was asleep, you see. And then the next day he wasn't there and he never came back. And I thought, oh God, where's he gone? And then he told the school when I got back. So I kind of got a bit ostracised when I went back.
So when you got the girlfriend then, that you mentioned earlier, was that to kind of cover up? If you'd already been outed at school, were you trying to cover up?
No, I don't think it was to cover up. I mean, I kind of I suppose some way maybe it was to please my parents, but I really wanted to try it just in case, you know?
And did you have sex with her?
Yeah.
And did you like it?
It was quite nice, but it wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you say you wanted to have a girlfriend partly to please your parents. So what did your parents say then when you finally came out to them?
I think they weren't shocked because I'd said to my mum, I'd written her a letter and said, oh, I'm bisexual. And then I wrote her another one and said, well, you know, I said, oh, I'm bisexual. Well, I'm not. I'm gay. So they were fine, you know. I mean, I took a boyfriend home when all the children were still living there, my sisters and brothers, and we slept in the same bed.
Oh, so they were progressive.
They were really sweet, honestly. And I remember hearing my sisters outside the door, the bedroom door, because they said, oh, Andy's sleeping with Danny, you know, in the same bed. And they said, so? They said, that's because they love each other. They said, you love your sister, don't you?
Oh.
Like that, you know.
That's really advanced for
amazing.
Them, isn't it?
Amazing, really amazing.
But, interestingly, one of my gay heroes, Andy Bell, I would have thought you would be a gold star gay, but you went through a bisexual phase and you've had sex with a girl.
Oh, right. Wow.
I've not done either. So I've out-gayed you on both.
Oh, good.
Tell us about... So let's go back to when you moved to London with this girlfriend.
Yeah.
But I would love to know, if you'd been so sexually frustrated as a young gay man, what was it like when you started to explore your identity and go to clubs and all this?
To be honest, I mean, I kind of feel kind of jealous of George Michael, you know, because I think he's explored every avenue that he wanted to, and I don't think that I have, you know.
Oh, really?
You know, I think a lot to do with my shyness as well. You know, I mean, I've been all around the world and everything, but, you know, even kind of going to bathhouses or whatever, you know, I wouldn't hardly do anything because I just felt like... I think especially as we became more and more famous as well, you know, I remember one time being in Amsterdam and this guy was, like, doing a blowjob on me, and then he goes, oh, you really look like that guy from Eurasia. And I thought, oh, this is it now. You know, I'm not going to...
Yeah, but to be honest, I think when you put it all out there anyway, in your public persona, would it have been a big story that you got a blowjob from a guy in Amsterdam?
Well, probably not, no. I mean, you know, it was... that was the thing. It was kind of like... I think it's because I can't let go.
So when you say you're jealous of George Michael for doing everything, you mean everything sexually. You mean you're quite vanilla and you're quite inhibited sexually.
I wouldn't say I was inhibited, but let's say... I mean, I've been to a few of those kind of, like, S&M type, you know, parties and things, but I'd never surrendered myself to the... full goings-on in whatever's happening in there.
Yeah, but you're saying that as if it's a bad thing. If it's not part of who you are...
Right,
I mean, if people like doing that, that's great.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think it's something worse than forcing yourself to do it because you feel you should.
Right.
And, you know, you don't feel good about yourself afterwards if that's the case.
Right. I mean, I haven't thought about it that much, but, you know, maybe I just felt I wasn't complete, like a complete
gay person. I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
There's still plenty of time, darling.
No. No, I'm married now, so.
Are you married?
Yeah.
Who to?
I'm married to Stephen, who's we live half in Miami and half here.
So, oh, right. Yeah. Well, I didn't know any of this. Right, let's take right, you're getting a cigarette out. Yeah. Let's have a little pause while you smoke a fag. Okay. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about Stephen and lots of other stuff.
All right.
We're going to get back to Andy now, but a quick reminder that Attitude Heroes is sponsored by the Great Britain Campaign, which welcomes the world to visit, do business, invest and study in the UK. You can check out their website at great.gov.uk. And our co-sponsors are Jaguar. If you'd like more information on their products, then you can visit the website jaguar.co.uk or look out for them in the latest issue of Attitude magazine.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So you come to London. What about when you went to your first gay bar or club?
Yeah.
What was that like? Did you feel like, I found my people, I'm here?
Well, apart from, I can't really remember the sequence, but apart from going to some gay bars, my first ever club was the Embassy Club. So I probably chose the wrong one to go to.
Well, I don't know the Embassy. What was?
Because it was on a Sunday night, but it was like really posh because it was like in Chelsea or somewhere like that.
It's a posh club for posh gays.
Yeah, like really posh, you know, and I went there and, but I do remember like having such an exhilarating experience because it was, you'd pay like £10 or maybe £5 then and get a free drink, you know, and have gin and tonic or whatever. And then, and I just remember I Feel Love being on by Donna Summer and just all these guys standing round that just looked like models, like to me. You know, and I mean, the music was, for me, the saving grace. It was the most exhilarating, uplifting music that I'd ever heard, even though I'd probably heard it before, but it was just this place it was being played in.
So did you feel like, you know, when you started discovering the scene rather than this specific club, this is what I was waiting for, this is what I wanted?
I think once I started finding the right places, which was more... when they had cheap nights, you know, being on benefits and things. You know,
once you got out to the posh place and got the cheap places.
Yeah, you know, when you go to like Heaven on Wednesday or the Bell Pub, and the Bell was really amazing. That was like really instrumental in my awareness.
And you mentioned the music. I've always been interested. What do you think it is about high energy, electropop, uplifting, accessible pop music? Why does it appeal to so many gay men? Because if you go from Sylvester and Disco in the 70s and then ABBA, obviously you're a huge fan, you recorded a whole EP, Kylie Steps, you know, why do you think fluffy escapist pop has always appealed to so many gay men?
Because I think it reminds you of the kind of patheticness of real life.
That's a hilarious theory.
I think so. Because it's just so fluffy and just light and nonsense. And, you know, it's like when you realise kind of like how the media really is, you know, and the news is just a cycle going round and... I don't know. I mean, it's not that you think it's pathetic, but it's kind of like it's so throwaway and
Well, there's a theory, isn't there, that if you're going through lots of intense, twisted emotions in your head, you know, because you're trying to work out who you are and your desires aren't just innocent, they're all kind of mixed up with all this intense shit.
Yeah.
Suddenly you hear some light throwaway Kylie
and
you just forget about all that and you just disappear into the fluff.
Yes. I mean, in the beginning with the high energy music, which I couldn't really quite understand, but sometimes you did sort of get into that, like So Many Men, So Little Time, just that like uplifting, up beats, you know, and you really felt like that. You really felt like being a rabbit in the headlights, that you had to sleep with so many men in such a in a short time, because all the music, all the songs were all about that. Then
there's a lot of pressures and expectations with gay men, isn't it? You've already said you feel like you should have been to S&M clubs and blah, blah, blah. And you just said you had to sleep with the pressure to have to sleep with so many men. Where does that come from? Our culture's been so sexualized historically, hasn't it?
I think it was just from the initial abandonment of maybe just like disregarding convention and throwing the rules away. I don't know. Just from like having everything and the whole world being your oyster kind of thing. And you
people
know,
go mad. It's like the lids come off.
Yes, yeah. It's like you say.
But you were very much a one man woman. You always liked having a boyfriend, and
yes, I mean it was kind of it was very strange. I mean, when I met Paul at the same time as I met Vince, and then Paul discovered he was HIV after about 2 years in our relationship.
Oh.
So he would no longer be like really intimate, you know, and I wasn't really prepared to be safe, I suppose, with him. And so he gave me my freedom to go out, and so I wasn't monogamous with him, which is kind of like, I mean, that's one regret that I have about, I know I shouldn't have them, but about our relationship, is that I really wish I'd appreciated his love.
Oh.
You know, I really do.
But you were with him for 25 years.
I was with him for 25 years.
Are you sure you're not... I mean, surely the act of staying with him for 25 years is appreciative on some level.
Well, he was a lovely guy. He was so fierce. He was so protective of me. I think in the end, it became... I mean, he passed away, but it kind of became... You know, we were together right until the end. But I think we were ready to kind of separate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know.
Do you mind if I ask?
Yeah.
So you say you were together for 2 years and then he found out he was HIV.
Yeah.
But you hadn't been safe until that point.
No.
So you were lucky then in those days.
I was very lucky, yeah, because I had been tested because there had been a scare story around about me and that was going to be in the press, which never surfaced. But that's, you know, I'd infected someone and I had been tested because I'd had my appendix removed. Then and I was away on tour, and Paul had to take this letter to this particular newspaper proving that I was negative.
Talk about an attack, victimization. How dare they?
And then they had, you know, then we had the police coming round saying, "Do you want to prosecute the guy that had made this accusation?" And I just felt sorry for him. I said no.
But, right, so you knew you were HIV negative then, but he was positive. And you've since publicly come out and said that you are HIV positive now. So do you know how you were infected and when you were diagnosed?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I did, you know, I did have other lovers. I had one guy in Amsterdam, but I really honestly don't know.
So you were diagnosed in 98?
Yes.
And by this stage, we've got combination drug therapy. It doesn't
necessarily... Thankfully, it was kind of... I think it was the tail end of AZT.
Oh, God.
Just, yeah.
So if you already had a partner who was HIV positive, what did it mean to you? How did you feel when you were diagnosed?
Well, I just think we just went through this very bleak black period, both of us. You know, I think probably for about... maybe 10 years, you know, where we're just oblivious, taking drugs and not even leaving the house. My body was breaking down, you know, and I was kind of like in denial really about it, about the whole thing. And just had so many things going wrong, like, you know, shingles and really nasty things, you know. And then once I kind of like, I got pneumonia, and this was in Mallorca, and they just said straight away, you know, oh, we're going to do a test and.
What, to see if it was full-blown AIDS?
Yes, and they said, well, you know, you're positive. And the criteria then was if you had double pneumonia, it was considered being AIDS. So, you know, I was very lucky. It was kind of...
Well, in some sense, it's lucky in that you're still here now.
Yeah.
When you consider, you know, what happened to others.
Yes.
But that's quite, there's quite a, if you grow up being made to feel ashamed of who you are and then you get this disease, there's a lot of shame attached and there's still all this stigma.
Yeah.
It's quite a lot to, it's no surprise to me that you then entered this dark period.
Yeah.
So you talk about regret. What do you, if you could speak to the man that you were then going through that experience, what would you say to yourself?
I don't know if I would relive my life any differently. You know, because I wouldn't know what I know now. So, but at the same time, I think I was incredibly naive when I started out and kind of thinking I was going to conquer the world and all this stuff, you know, when you're younger. And then, I don't know. I think I just would have been more caring about other people.
And how caring were the people to you? Because, you know, as I said, there was a lot of shame attached to HIV. There's still a stigma. So you were diagnosed in 98 and you came out as HIV positive in 2004. So did you not come out for a while because you knew that there would be stigma?
I mean, I didn't come out because I was really scared. Yeah, I was really scared. Then especially after that newspaper, you know, story. I just felt like then you know, and to be honest, I'm kind of like, I'm very thankful that after we had the ABBA EP come out and we were really famous, and I just said, oh God, please can you switch it off? And then that's what happened.
So you started to go off the rails after that?
Yeah. You know, and I think, I don't know if it was that hubris thing or just readjusting, you know, to like from being in the limelight to not being in the limelight. I don't know. But I think it was actually taking time for you.
Yeah.
Rather than just, because the, you know, when you're in a band, I think the hardest thing is to learn how to say no, because you just end up doing everything.
But like you say, you had it, you kind of, you know, to go from being a shy person to having extreme fame, to taking a step back from it, to having a secret that you didn't want to reveal, you know, there's a lot going on there, isn't it? It feels like, I mean, have you been looking after yourself? Have you had therapy and that kind of thing?
I have had therapy, and to be honest, I'm quite surprised that I'm not totally bonkers. You know, I mean, I'm sure I'm quite mad compared to some people, but I think I pretty much got my feet on the ground, you know, and I've never been one of these kind of people that would use fame for revenge or anything like that, you know? And, yeah.
So you're mentally well. Are you physically well?
Yeah, I feel really great now. I mean, I hadn't been to the gym for ages, but... because it's so boring. But because we're going on tour now, you have to, you know.
Well, so you're going on tour, so let's talk about your brilliant new album.
Yeah.
You've just celebrated 30 years of Erasure.
Yep.
You've got a fantastic new album, which I love. Interestingly, it's some of the songs are a bit more reflective and slower paced.
Yeah.
What's prompted this then?
Well, I just felt like I just wanted to be real, you know, and not do pop.
Oh, is pop not real then?
Well, I just felt like because we'd been on this treadmill of kind of like trying to write a pop song.
Yeah.
And I think after a while it doesn't work anymore.
I've just thought, you've answered the question I asked you a while ago when I said, why do so many gay men love fluffy pop?
Yeah.
It's because it's not real.
It's escapist.
Yeah. That's that simple, isn't it? When reality isn't working for you.
Yeah.
You want something that's not real.
Yeah.
Anyway, your new album is responding to the real world. There's some political stuff in there as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
bits, because obviously, yeah, especially after Brexit and stuff and Trump, I know that it's just they're easy targets, but I just felt so kind of despondent about it, you know, and I just thought the British people were a bit wiser.
But... Well, interestingly, though, you say you feel despondent. The message that I get from the album is quite positive at the same time.
Well, it's always uplifting, I think, whatever we do, because that's always my inner choir boy crying for salvation. The yearning.
Yeah, well, in terms of the positivity, you know, things are... I know that there's things like Brexit, Trump, and I know that the far right is in the ascendance again. Yeah. But what I was going to say was, if you look back to when you were growing up in Peterborough, the situation for gay men, at least in this country, is immeasurably better.
Yeah, it's huge.
Did you ever think that situation would come about?
I always felt like I was born ahead of my time in some ways, and behind in the wrong time, because I think I would have been much better as a 40s crooner, you know, and as a silent movie actor. But so in some ways, I kind of, even though I said I don't like teenagers very much, I just feel like the world has evolved so far beyond my expectations, even for having a vivid imagination, that young people are so far ahead of, like, what I ever thought, you know, we could be. Because it's... And they don't even... They're not bothered
about anything. I sometimes feel jealous about how complacent they are, about how brilliant their world is.
Yeah.
You know.
And so sometimes I get that... I get the nostalgia for the, you know, for the good old... The coming out days, you know. Because to me it was kind of... I mean, it was really exciting, and you felt like you were doing something, and now you kind of feel like it's all a bit by the wayside, and, you know.
What do you think about the gay community now? It compared to, you know, you talked about the scene when you were first finding your feet as a gay man, but, you know, there's a lot of talk about the scene, you know, falling away and not being less relevant than it used to be, and gay bars closing. But it strikes me that actually... We use the word community, but still the only places for us to meet up and come together involve drink or drugs or sex.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think it maybe it got saturated a bit with gay bars. Maybe there was too much choice around, you know. I mean, like in the 80s, it was like there wasn't that many gay bars. I mean, there was a lot in London, but it's probably only about 20 to 30 bars maybe. And now, I mean, there are pockets, you know, places that are fun to go to, you know.
Are there any gay bars in Peterborough?
There were three at one time. Not when I was living there, but then it used to be rumoured the back bar of the Bull Hotel, which I went there, but there was nobody there. and then another time, you know, there were three pubs going at once, but I don't think there is one now. I think it's like a once a month social.
But how do you feel when you look back at what the scene was like then and what it's like now?
I don't know. I kind of liked it then when I was growing up, when I first moved to London, because it was much rougher. And I don't mean in a sexual context, but because in some ways you were kind of threatened, so you were kind of like pulled together you know, in the bar. So it was kind of like, and we did things together. You went on marches together.
Well, Paul O'Grady, I spoke to about a lot.
Yeah,
he said there was a sense of community.
There really was. Yeah, you know, and it was, and the music was great. Not like it is now.
And what about things like, you know, that you always read about saunas and sex apps and chemsex parties.
Right,
what do you think about this aspect of contemporary gay culture?
To be honest, I don't really know. You know, I kind of like... I do fear that kind of abandonment as well sometimes. I don't mean for myself, but for other people. You know, I think you can get so lost in it and wrapped up in it and kind of like not caring about your body at all, you know, and kind of just wearing yourself out through it. And,
well, there's definitely a complacency towards HIV, isn't there?
Yes, definitely, yeah.
How does that make you feel then after your experiences?
Well, I just think it's... People just take it too lightly, you know. I would take a cure tomorrow if there was one.
But you say you'd take a cure. Do you think when young people are complacent and barebacking and they don't realise what's involved?
I think you can't tell a young person. It's impossible, I don't think. I mean, you can drum it home to them, but I think when you're young, you're just so... You want to be free.
Well, they want that abandonment, yes, don't they, that you were talking about.
Yeah.
But by the time you get to your age, you've settled down. Yeah. You slipped in earlier that you were married.
Yeah.
So who's the lucky fella there?
3 years. Well, we've been together 5 years, and Stephen, I met just really amazingly, and I had the same feeling as when I met Paul. And the thing that's always struck me, only on these two occasions I would call loves of my life, is who's this strange person? You know, that was the initial...
So you were intrigued and curious rather than thinking he's gorgeous, I want to fuck him.
Yes, yes. It was on both occasions. And with Stephen, he's been amazing. He's completely non-judgmental. And, when we first met, I went with these two guys on the boat one time. And he said, I'd much rather you didn't. So I thought, I'm going to respect him. And
So you were in an early relationship with him and you got off with two men on a boat?
Yes. That was really, really early on, that was.
Yeah.
But I want to respect him and respect myself for doing it, you know?
So you were in an open relationship, because this is quite a hot topic amongst gay people. I've noticed from Attitude's website and our social media feeds, open relationships. You had an open relationship with Paul for 25 years, but now you're in a monogamous...
Yeah, well, I wouldn't necessarily call that an open relationship because we were platonic in the end, you see.
Okay.
Which is, that's really hard, because I wasn't allowed to fall in love with anybody.
Yeah.
You know, so you can have sex but not fall in love, so... That is really hard because you're cutting your heart off all the time, you know.
But you've had a happy ending and you found love. It's
amazing.
Now.
I mean, I met Stephen at the same time when Paul was becoming ill, and he really helped me because he had lost his father through cancer, you know, and I wasn't looking for someone at all, you know. And I just happened to be going and doing this PA. His club. He's got a club in Tampa.
And he's American.
Yeah, he's American. And we just looked at each other and it was like, wow, you know, one of those feelings of and he was like a punk cage dancer.
So he's not an Erasure fan?
York.
He wasn't an Erasure fan?
No, not really, you know, and just, I don't know.
But you said you split your time between there and here.
Yeah.
So I'm intrigued because I've been around a while now and I've never seen you out and about at the gay parties and events and award ceremonies.
Right.
Do you keep yourself to yourself because you're shy or because you've been in relationships or grieving or...?
It's probably a bit of both of those things, but I do go to things. I go to the Terence Higgins Trust thing, galas and things, and National AIDS Trust things. You know, I go out with my lesbian friends, you know, and I go around the corner here to the ship and the grapes and maybe the Friendly Society. I'd love to go to the Glory. I've never been there yet.
Oh, I went there for the first time last weekend. I loved it.
Yeah, I'd love to go there.
I'll take you to the Glory.
Okay.
I loved it.
It's a deal. Yeah.
Because I genuinely think if you look at the gay icons and heroes from the era that you first became successful and famous, so many of them have been celebrated so much more than you. Yeah. I don't think your story has been told as much as it should have done. Would you agree? How do you feel about that?
I do feel that sometimes, yeah. I feel like we chose the right name with Erasure. You know, and it's the same way I felt about ABBA. They were forgotten for ages.
Yeah, until you came along and...
Yeah, so maybe it's just you gravitate to the ones you love, you know.
But I think you need to know how important you were to so many gay men. I think you need to know how important you were to this gay man growing up. You changed my life.
Well, I mean, it is lovely, you know, I get lots of people coming up to me in North America and South America, different places, and just saying thank you and stuff like that. And I just think, sometimes, I didn't do that much, really. I just said,
though.
who I was.
You were true to yourself publicly.
Yeah.
That's a big thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's been great to meet you. I'm not frightened of you anymore.
No, good.
Andy Bell, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Andy Bell from Erasure. And their new album, World Begone, is out now. I want to say a quick thanks to you if you've shared this podcast series, either online or just by telling a friend about it, because we now have a record number of subscribers. These podcasts are sponsored by the Great Britain Campaign, which welcomes the world to visit, do business, invest and study in the UK. Check out their website at great.gov.uk. And our co-sponsors are Jaguar. If you'd like more information on their products, then you can visit the website jaguar.co.uk or look out for them in the latest issue of Attitude magazine. I'll be back in a couple of weeks to let you know who my next special guest is. For now, take care, and I'll see you on the next Attitude Heroes.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.